What do we mean by an emotion? That's really the first question to ask. Buddhism is really quite precise on this, although it doesn't actually speak of emotion directly. An emotion is in fact a volitional activity accompanied by a feeling. A volitional activity accompanied by a feeling. There's a lot of confusion in the West with respect to mental states, mental phenomena, simply because we haven't grown up in an environment which encourages introspection of the sort which the Orient practices, simply because we haven't developed the language necessary to define our terms properly in that regard. We speak in the West of feelings of anger, feelings of frustration, feelings of love, feelings of happiness, and so on. Buddhism doesn't recognize anger, frustration, love, etc., as feelings, but more as volitional activities accompanied by feeling. And there is, in fact, quite a distinct difference between the two. The East is very, very precise in this regard, and again, that stems from its long history of dealing with the mind and with a mental search, a spiritual search, and having to find out precisely what it is that goes on in the mind and categorize it in a way which is useful to that particular endeavor. Buddhism then recognizes only three feelings: pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neutral feeling. No more. So a feeling of anger is not a recognizable term within the Buddhist orbit of analysis. Mental feelings then are those three kinds: pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Buddhism recognizes a large number of volitional tendencies, of habitual tendencies, of, if you like, states of mind, which the main component of which is volition. Volition is that aspect of the mind which pulls together, which directs, which marshals the forces of the mind. Some of those volitional tendencies are anger, love, compassion, hatred, frustration, distraction, initial application of mind, sustained application of mind, right livelihood. And that's in the moment, remember. There are in fact 50 of these, quite precisely documented, quite precisely defined, and capable of experience by anyone who has the eyes to see. Those are true to fact, in the sense that through meditation, through observation, one can discover that these things do exist. They do have a particular flavor, a particular function. And they will always be accompanied by a feeling, because feeling is present in every single moment of consciousness. It can range from very weak to very strong, but it is always present. And if you go back to what I was just saying, that there can only be three kinds of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, or painful, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, then you'll see that we have, in a sense, reduced our emotional context to a rather different order than we have in the West. It's not a mass of emotions to deal with as such. It's three feelings and a number of volitional activities of mind. Now, many people experience a very rich emotional life. They find many ups and downs, many happinesses and sorrows in their day-to-day living, and then perhaps they come across Buddhism and they fear that it will somehow destroy the emotions, that it will somehow eradicate their emotional life so that they become a sort of cold, calculating thing and not a living, breathing, emoting human being, and fearing that that might happen, clearly they become somewhat biased against Buddhism before even they've properly got into it. And I think it's important to try and clear up the almost inevitable misunderstandings that can arise, West versus East, in this area of emotion, because it's one that's central to many, many people, and one which does need further expansion. The lines of demarcation are really quite confused. So just to recap then, an emotion, strictly, is a volitional activity of some kind in association with a feeling. I'd like perhaps to try and give you some examples of volitional activity. Okay, I've given you some terms, but that's not quite good enough. Depression is a volitional activity. That means that anyone who is depressed wants to be. They work at maintaining it. Have you never found yourself depressed, met with somebody who refuses to accept the fact that you are depressed and tries to jolly you out of it? You resist like crazy. But usually, if the other one goes on long enough, suddenly something gets through and you find yourself laughing in spite of yourself. And in that very moment, if you look carefully, you can see that you were hanging on desperately to that depression. You were doing everything in your power to keep it in being. You were putting in a lot of volitional activity to perpetuate the depression. I don't know anyone who hasn't had that experience, if they're really honest and open with themselves. People talk about a nervous breakdown as though somehow it were inevitable. A nervous breakdown is chosen by the individual. I don't mean that they suddenly decide one morning that they're going to have a nervous breakdown that day. Of course not. What they do is choose in small ways, in small decisions, in small events, they choose to operate in what one might call a neurotic way rather than in an efficient way. And those small choices gradually set the direction of a life so that a person ends up inevitably progressing towards what we call, or what the West calls, a nervous breakdown. Reminds me of a pupil that Cappy, our teacher, had a long time ago now. This was a man in his mid-40s who suffered from clinical depression. He'd had one or two nervous breakdowns, indeed several nervous breakdowns in the past. He had met Cappy, I think, via going to a lecture and become a student of his, practicing meditation under Cappy's direction. He'd been at it for quite some time, I think about 18 months or so, if I remember rightly, and was on a meditation retreat under Cappy's guidance. And Cappy became aware one day that all was not as it should be, all was not well with this particular student. So he went to his room and found this guy huddled in the corner of the room, sitting on his bed, all with his arms around his legs, all crunched up into a ball, staring with eyes all bloodshot and terrible. And he looked at Cappy, and he'd known him when he was called Bill, just to confuse the issue, and said, "Bill, you bastard," he said, "I can't even enjoy my nervous breakdowns anymore now." Because he'd seen that he was doing it to himself. He'd seen that it was a volitional activity. He had seen that he could have chosen to do something different. And when you do see something in that way, it becomes very much harder to indulge yourself in the, in this case, negative emotion or depression or nervous breakdown or whatever. Elation is a volitional activity. If you have a whole mess of outstanding tasks to do and you don't really feel like it, generally you get depressed, don't you? That, as we've said, is a volitional activity. If, however, you buckle to, you tackle all of those tasks one by one, you work hard at them and you clear them out of the way, you suddenly feel as though a huge weight has been lifted off your shoulders. Life gets brighter by the moment, and within a very short time you're on top of the world. Indeed, not just on top, but flying high. You're elated, you're floating several feet off the ground. You feel as though perhaps you could walk through a brick wall and not notice it. You're unstoppable, you are elated, almost megalomaniac. That too is a volitional activity. You have put in the volitions to bring that about. You have put in the volitions to maintain it. And there are many, many more. But those few should suffice to give you some flavour of what I mean by a volitional activity. We could say, in short, that there are positive and negative emotions, or perhaps better, efficient and inefficient volitional activities. That's much more precise. I think you'd agree. The inefficient ones are, without exception, selfish. The efficient ones are unselfish. The inefficient states are those which we refer to in the West as something like coarse emotions. The efficient ones are those we refer to as perhaps finer feelings or some similar term. But they're still volitional activities accompanied by feeling. To try and show you how confused we are in the West about this whole area, I'm going to take just one volitional activity, one emotion, as we understand it in the West, and try and show you the range of that as we use the term in the Western world. The emotion in question is love, a term that's bandied around an awful lot. But what does it really mean? What does that term stand for? It can stand for sex. Very often does. Popular songs, popular terminology, making love doesn't really have anything to do with the finer feeling of love. It's talking about pure physical sex very often. So already that's a little bit confusing. Very often what passes for love, what is called love, is sheer attachment. One clings to something or someone in a selfish way, trying desperately to hold that thing or person to one and not lose it. That's certainly not a finer feeling, but it's called love. There's the craving to possess something, also called love. There's possessiveness itself, the possessiveness perhaps sometimes of a mother for children who won't let them go, who keeps them tied to the apron strings, who will not in any way allow them room to grow, room to get into danger by themselves. Overprotection in that sense. That's called love as well. But again, it's possessiveness, pure and simple. Under the term love also comes domination of one person by another. Some relationships are founded on domination of one partner by the other. It's called love, but it's sheer selfish domination in some cases. All of those I've just mentioned are based upon craving. They're all extremely selfish, as I think you can see. Some of them may well be pleasant whilst they're being pursued, but without exception, the resultants from those volitional activities are painful. They are unpleasant. Still talking about love, it can mean kindliness. Wanting to be at ease with others. Wanting not to upset other people. Wanting to help other people. And then it becomes compassion. It can be altruism. Not thinking of oneself at all, but trying to do something for the greater good of one's immediate group, or indeed humanity as a whole. All of these things are called love in the West. It may be allowing people freedom to breathe, freedom to move, freedom to do their own thing. That's often called love, and rightly so. It might, on the other hand, be discipline. How do you train a puppy? Not by allowing it to do its own thing the whole time. Why do you train a puppy? So it doesn't become a menace both to itself and to other people. So it's altruistic to a degree. So the enforcing of discipline can be a form of love. Joy at other success. That's a rare thing, but it does exist. And that's love too, as we understand it in the West. So the one emotion, love, as we understand it in the West, covers everything from the grossest to the most subtle aspects of living. Covers everything from the most gross craving and attachment up to the finest subtlety of altruism and true love for fellow beings. No wonder we get a little bit confused. For things like kindness, compassion, altruism and the like, many of these particular activities are really quite painful at times to pursue. They cost one something in terms of effort, self-deprivation sometimes. They cost one quite a lot. But without exception, their resultants are pleasant because they are essentially efficient volitional activities. They are essentially based in non-craving, non-hatred, and unselfishness in relative terms. So, once again, an emotion is a volitional activity accompanied by a feeling. Whilst pursuing any one of those activities I've just mentioned, one might experience in the present moment pleasure or indeed sometimes pain. And that in a sense isn't terribly important. It's what resultants come from that really determine just how that emotion or that activity, that volitional activity, is to be assessed. All of the volitional activities accompanied by unselfishness will produce pleasant results in the future, and that's not just for oneself but for other people too. All of the inefficient ones accompanied by selfishness, by craving, by hatred in some cases, those will be the cause of painful resultants in the future, and again, not only for oneself but also for other people. So what then does happen to emotions in Buddhism? The Eightfold Path, as we understand it, leads us to the cessation of ignorance, of craving, and of hatred, and of course of selfishness in any form, because selfishness will only be found where there's ignorance present. Indeed, you could say that craving and hatred are selfishness. Many believe that the Buddhist way then points to the total elimination of emotions. Now, being goal-orientated, as most of us are in the Western world, we decide that we must hurry along the process as much as we can. And so we take it upon ourselves, some of us, to crush out the emotions, to stamp them down, to push them away, to eradicate them as quickly as we can, believing thereby that we are somehow accomplishing the goal of Buddhism. But what a mistake. Because to try to crush them out is to hazard one's sanity. They cannot be crushed out. They can be set aside temporarily, but they can never be just forcefully eradicated from the mind. The Eightfold Path is divided into three sections: Sila, Samadhi, Panya, or, if you prefer, Discipline, Concentration and Wisdom. People try to overcome the emotions they feel they should not have by self-control, which is equivalent to discipline, also by suppression, which is equivalent to concentration. They concentrate so hard that they force out the particular emotion that they feel they should somehow avoid. Such people then come to a point where maybe they think, well, I never get angry, or I'm totally free from envy or jealousy, whatever it might be, because they've done a superlative job of covering it up in this way. And that's really rather a pity, because that, in fact, is to adhere to the path of self-mortification. One is doing oneself a mischief by hiding away all the things that one does not like, does not want. They're useful techniques to use in social interaction and as a temporary measure to bring a balance to the mind, but as a final answer, they are useless. The eradication of inefficient states is only through enlightenment wisdom, through that wisdom generated through vipassana meditation, through insight meditation. And that insight itself is only generated through attention to things as they actually are, which means not only the good stuff, but the bad stuff as well. So, with enlightenment, with the culmination of the Buddhist path, one can see that the coarse emotions must disappear, because those are based on ignorance, craving and hatred. Ignorance, craving and hatred are eradicated. Therefore, the coarse, selfish, volitional activities obviously disappear. So to that extent, the emotions do go. Resultant feelings still occur, mark you. That's important to recognize. There's lots of stuff one's done in the past that still has a potential for a resultant, and if the supporting circumstances are right, then those resultants will occur. It's like a watch. You might have wound your watch up and decided that in effect you no longer need it, and you put it in the cupboard, but having wound it up, it's still got to unwind, and that may take quite a long time. And it's the same with the resultants generated from previous actions. They still have to, as it were, unwind. Now, it's said, and rightly, that an arahant, an enlightened being, produces no more volitional activities. And this is a problem that has occupied many of the world's best thinkers for quite some long time. Because if he doesn't produce any volitional activities, if there's no volition present in his makeup in that sense, then clearly he can't exist, and so therefore he must go up in a puff of blue smoke. But the key here, as in the whole of the Buddhist way, is to recognize that volitional activities in this context are always related to the dualistic view of the universe, where there's always me and there's that. There's self, there's other. So it's based in an essential ignorance right from the start. Once that's transcended, the idea of self and other, then you can't say that volition, in that strict sense, exists any longer, and thus the enlightened being produces no more volitional activities. If he produces no more volitional activities, then one has to say, in one sense, that all emotions do disappear. However, there's a very big but attached to that. Emotions only exist within the framework of self or non-self, within that relative framework between the coarsest selfishness you can imagine to the most refined altruism you can imagine. That is the sphere of emotions. That is the world, if you like. The enlightened being has gone beyond the world. He's transcended both selfish and unselfish. He's transcended self, non-self. He's transcended all the opposites. And as such, then, is totally at one with the whole universe. And there cannot be said to be any separation whatsoever. So there's no distinction whatsoever, then, between self and other. Being at one with everything, with everyone, one could speak of the enlightened being as acting on himself or herself. As reality, if you like, acting with and on itself. The enlightened person, the enlightened being, sees the whole universe as himself, in one sense. Again, that's to distort the truth, that's to make illogical nonsense of it, but to give you a flavour, it's the best I can do. Sees the whole universe as himself, and so, therefore, he'd no more hurt another than he would wound himself. He'd no more go out and stamp on somebody or some creature than he would stamp on himself. So, to that degree, the enlightened being epitomizes all of those finer feelings that we were talking about earlier. He epitomizes metta, kindliness, loving kindness, compassion, joy at other success, charity, all of those things. The enlightened being is like a mirror, reflecting every nuance of the environment. So, the rich patterns of life and experience flow in and flow through for such a one, with no grasping and no attempt to avoid or push away. There's no resistance of any kind to anything that life has to offer. And so one could say that such a person has a supremely rich emotional life with no dissatisfaction whatsoever, because everything is absolutely perfect as it is. Everything is totally spontaneous. There's no trying to stop the flow, either by grasping or by pushing things away. And one can say, perhaps, again inaccurately, but it'll do, that the emotions have become refined to the point where they are indeed full and rich and worthwhile. And, most importantly, totally harmless to self or to others. It is truly being at one with the universe. Thank you.